This is an audio disc recording of Chapter 3 from the novel Void Where Prohibited, A Story of Love and Murder. The reading is by the author, Mike Borges. As Void Where Prohibited begins, Ralph is hopelessly in debt, but when his loan shark suggests the murder of Ralph's wife, Bonnie, for the insurance money, he is appalled. He's a putz, maybe, possibly, all right if you say so, but a criminal? A murderer? His own family? All he can think to do is get up and storm out of the room. Nevertheless, it happens. The story of how murder comes about, and what follows, is recounted in two threads that are interwoven in alternate chapters. One thread traces the crime, the automobile collision that changes Ralph's mind, the criminal investigation, and the trial. The other thread focuses on Bonnie's family, their loving and supportive relationship, the shock and grief after Bonnie's mother discovers the body, and the life-changing ramifications following the verdict. And now for Chapter 3. I hope you enjoy it. Thank you. Chapter 3. Subsequent investigation by the police revealed that on Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, Ralph made a stop in Chelsea. Chelsea is an industrial backwater adjacent to Boston. It is linked with the Charlestown section of Boston by the Tobin Bridge, which carries U.S. Route 1 north toward the upper reaches of the New England coast. But Charlestown, benefiting from its pre-industrial charm, its proximity to downtown, and the cachet of a revolutionary past that includes Bunker Hill, has been gentrified to a fare-thee-well. It is, for example, the locale of the restaurant Olives, home base for the culinary empire of celebrity chef Todd English. Chelsea, meanwhile, is a sad sack of a town, a lonely wallflower, never invited to dance during the urban revitalization parties of recent decades, which animated the rest of the Boston real estate scene. It was left with a housing stock, a central business district, and an economic base which are not merely old but tired. What we have here is the town that marketing forgot, a city of 35,000 souls bereft of even a single solitary Starbucks. The dominant physical feature in Chelsea is the elevated Route 1 viaduct attached to the northern end of the bridge. The Tobin Bridge itself, as it crosses the Mystic River, is a picturesque assembly of steel girders and trusses perched on conical pilasters. Not especially when you're driving on it, but very much when you're looking at it. The effect is airy and lacy and rather nice. Although built in 1950, the design has an aesthetic sensibility more reflective of the 19th century, a celebration of the age of steel manifest with admirable clarity of concept and refinement in execution. The half-mile viaduct, however, ripping through the heart of Chelsea, is one god-awful piece of crap. It is massive, it is gross, it is double-decked and painted a bilious green. It is in places 6 stories high. It appears that at the time it was built, public works officials may have intended to do the city a favor by elevating the highway, thus preserving connectivity at street level between the two sides of town. If so, this is ironic. What they wrought was the road from hell paved over with their good intentions. But if the viaduct is a scar that disfigures the listless and dispirited face of Chelsea, the drama of ordinary life still roils beneath the surface, anything but listless and dispirited. In that, Chelsea is no different from anywhere else. And Ralph, as he exited from the viaduct that Friday morning onto Chestnut Street, was about to become a player in one of those dramas. I'll tell you the story as best we can reconstruct it from what was uncovered during the investigation. Descending to Chestnut and turning left on 2nd, Ralph heads to the parking lot at Mystic Mall. He's going to leave his car there, 3 blocks from his destination. No way is he about to allow his Lexus, less than a year old, to sit unattended on a street in Chelsea, even in daytime. The lot at the mall, teeming with activity and guarded by a security patrol, is a much better bet, he figures. So he has to walk a couple of blocks, no big deal. Ralph has been summoned to a dry cleaning establishment. This one is in a great location. It's on a busy street, close to apartments and businesses. It's within view of an on-ramp to the viaduct. It's a moneymaker. It makes some sense, then, that the store has a prosperous appearance. It is clean, modern. and therefore looks quite out of place in Chelsea. Ralph is not there to sell a copier. The store is a front for his bookie. This is a clever idea. It's open early, open late. There is heavy customer flow throughout the day. There are numerous cash transactions. Indeed, it is perfect. Ralph takes a deep breath and goes in. The electronic sensor sets off the electronic bell. Marcel is behind the counter. Marcel doesn't look like a Marcel. He looks like a Rocco. People call him Rocco. He encourages that. Though Ralph has been here often, this time there is no cordial greeting from Rocco. Instead, he gestures his head toward the back of the store and says, "The chief is expecting you." There's a section of the counter that's hinged to provide a pass-through. Ralph lifts it upright and heads towards the rear. Some of the space in back is used for dry cleaning equipment and operations. The remainder is occupied by one of those serpentine motorized racks that holds finished garments on hangers and moves them mechanically to the front when you push a button. The ranks of shirts, sweaters, and slacks in glistening plastic bags obscure from sight a plain unmarked door. Behind it is the chief's office. Ralph sweeps aside some shirts. He steps into the gap he's created and knocks on the door. He hears, "Yeah?" "It's Ralph," he says. "Ralph Collins." Yes, floats through the door. "Come in, Ralph Collins." Ralph does just that. The chief's office is generous, but not especially fancy. It has carpeting, but the indoor-outdoor type. There are no windows. The walls aren't blank, though. They are lined with floor-to-ceiling bookshelves. Nearly filled, the way you might expect to see in the den of a college professor. The chief has read most of these books, too. He's an educated man who thinks about things. The furniture is nondescript, except for his desk and chair. These are enormous, imposing, powerful. In contrast, the visitors' chairs are small and spindly. They won't collapse, but they seem as though they might. This is a ploy to nettle visitors and put them at a disadvantage. Once you see the chief in person, you don't forget what he looks like. His features are undistinguished, but he is tall, about 6'3", and exceedingly thin. Gaunt is how you would describe him, although he is not ill, he is just built that way. Sunken cheeks and a sharp nose accentuate a face that is already long and narrow. He is, in fact, just this side of concentration camp emaciated. He wears custom-made suits because anything off the rack looks baggy. There is no expansion in his chest, no bulge in his stomach, no widening of his hips, no gluteus in his maximus. If you had a napkin ring that just fit the top of his shoulders, it would slide down to his feet. The chief is content with the way he looks. He knows that his odd appearance is magnetic, that it rivets people's attention on him. He also feels that it leads people to underestimate him. That may or may not be the case, but in any event, those that would do so are likely to regret their miscalculation. It's not that the chief is by nature a violent sort. True, his line of business can be a tad rough and tumble on occasion, and for that eventuality, he has associates he can call on who are less fastidious than he. But, as a rule, he prefers to achieve his objectives by getting other people to see things his way. As it turns out, the chief finds the exercise of muscle rarely necessary. The background threat of it is usually quite sufficient. That, and the chief's power of logic and persuasion, which are more than a match for Ralph's. Overall, it is remarkable how often folks come to see things the chief's way. The chief gestures to invite Ralph to take a seat in one of the spindly chairs. He dispenses with the usual social niceties. "No, so how was your Thanksgiving?" "No, did you get any golf in before the weather closed in?" Just right away, all business. "So, Ralph Collins, how is life in the Tony suburb of Newton?" Ralph and Bonnie bought a house in the Tony suburb of Newton after Ralph made district manager. Ralph understands that the chief's question is neither friendly nor disingenuous. It is an oblique reference to the fact that Ralph has a big mortgage now, leaving less cash available to pay off his gambling debt. Ralph pretends to a sanguine nonchalance he doesn't really feel, and in his anxiety, he makes a mistake. "It's good," he says. "You know," he says, "one of the reasons we moved to Newton is the great school system. Now it looks like we did the right thing for the right reason. We just found out that Bonnie, my wife, Bonnie, she's pregnant." Never mind the cozy family photos on the credenza behind the desk. If Ralph is expecting a modicum of human warmth and collegiality from the chief, he is disabused of that notion pronto. The chief's eyes fix in on Ralph's. "A baby," he says softly. "A kid." This is the curtain raiser, the overture to a tirade. The chief will start quietly, then steadily ramp up the intensity and volume of his voice until it reaches a volcanic crescendo. "A kid. In your situation, Ralph Collins, do you have any idea how much a kid costs? Any clue? The slightest fragment of a scintilla of an idea? Have you fallen off the precipice of sanity into the bottomless abyss of unconstrained dementia? Ralph Collins, you are the world's perfect embodiment of an idiot. You, Ralph Collins, are the definitive example of a world-class brainless turd." All this is just theatrics, an improv performance intended to put Ralph on the defensive. It does. Ralph shifts awkwardly in his spindly chair, then concentrates on regaining his composure. With all the calm he can muster, he offers his explanation. "I know a kid is expensive. I've looked into it. But I had no choice. Bonnie was driving me crazy over it. She was obsessed with wanting a kid. She never let up. I couldn't stand it anymore. I couldn't say no anymore. My sanity was at stake. Not to mention I had exhausted all my excuses." The chief strokes his chin. "Interesting you should put it that way. You've exhausted all of your excuses here, too. And we also have the ability to put you, Ralph Collins, in a position where you can't say no. Interesting parallel." "Ralph, I'm doing the best I can." More chin-stroking by the chief. "I don't see it that way. For example, you're making payments on a Lexus. Not just any Lexus, mind you, but the expensive one. You could instead be making payments on a Camry or a Saturn or something, and paying me back the difference. It wouldn't be much, but it would be something. A token of your commitment to settling your account. How committed are you, Ralph Collins, to settling your account?" "I'm committed. I'm very committed. But I need a nice car for business. In sales, you need to look successful." "You telling me you think that someone who merely drives a late model Camry looks like a failure?" "Yeah, but I got a fantastic deal. My brother-in-law sells them, and he gave me a terrific price." "True, but they're killing you on the financing." The volume on the alarm bells ringing in Ralph's brain takes a quantum leap upward. "How do you know about my financing?" he says. The chief allows himself a limited smile. "We'll get to that soon enough." "Okay, well, it's the best I could get. My credit's a little shaky." "Shaky? Shaky? You're in over your head on your mortgage. Your credit cards are maxed out. You're making payments on a Lexus. That's merely what's on the books, the world according to Equifax. Off the books, you owe me roughly the national debt of a small African nation. Now you're having a baby. That's not shaky, that's Chernobyl." Ralph has progressed by now from nervous to inklings of dread. "How do you know about my credit cards?" The chief shows his annoyance. All right, we'll get to that now instead of later. This is simple, this is even legal. When you first came on board with me, you signed a form for a charge account with the laundry here. That was a standard form where you gave permission to a business creditor to obtain your credit report. That charge account is still open. I can get your credit reports any time I want, legitimately, just by asking for it and paying a small fee. Jesus, says Ralph, dismayed. He hadn't been aware of that. Let's get back to the subject of the car. Why? Because it illustrates your self-destructive combination of personal vanity and financial irresponsibility. Why didn't you lease it? Ralph is momentarily confused. Huh? The car. The fancy car you bought to keep up with your hoity-toity neighbors in Tony Newton. Why didn't you lease it? For once, Ralph thinks he has a good answer. It's cheaper to buy, he says with confidence, over the long run. The chief shakes his head. No sale. It's only better if you keep the car for a while. You never do that. You buy a new car every 2 or 3 years. For you, there is no long term. For 2 or 3 years, for the term of a lease, the economics are equivalent. It's a trade-off. No, chief, Ralph thinks he has him this time. A lease only covers 12,000 miles a year. I drive more than that. But the chief has known all along where he is taking this. Ah, yes. But if your wife drove the Lexus, you could still show it off in your driveway in Tony Newton, and she would run up less than 12,000 miles. Meanwhile, you could drive the new Impala your company gives you every other year, the one she's driving now, the one your company thinks is just fine for calling on customers. Ralph isn't keeping up. But why would I want to do that? The chief now shifts his tone in order to sound as patronizing as possible, knowing this will provoke Ralph to anger. Cash flow, Ralph Collins. I'm disappointed in you, Ralph Collins. You don't know the answer. The answer is cash flow. With a lease, you don't build up any equity, but in return, you get the benefit of lower monthly payments. And that, Ralph Collins, is what you need. You don't need to impress your customers with a car you can't afford. You need liquidity right now. Lower monthly payments. Ralph Collins, you made the wrong choice. Instead of making small payments on a Camry lease, you're making large payments on a Lexus financing. You know, Ralphie, the Jews have a terrific word for what you are. Putz. That's exactly what you are, Ralph Collins. You're a putz. As the chief intended, Ralph is furious. There is nothing that galls him more than disrespect. And the chief is rubbing his nose in it. But he can't do a thing about it. Ralph is in a precarious position, and he has little leverage, so he grimaces and says nothing. The chief, of course, cares nothing about the car. The whole routine is designed to humiliate Ralph as a means of dramatizing the power relationship between them. The chief picks up a manila folder from the top of a pile on his desk. Opening it, he says, Okay, enough chit-chat. Let's get down to business. Do you know how much you owe me? Ralph has a ballpark number in mind, but he thinks it's safer to play dumb. Not really, he answers. I guess it's quite a bit. Quite a bit indeed, the chief puts on his reading glasses and scans the top sheet of the file. Okay, here's a printout of your account. You've had a marker with me for 4 years now. Time does fly, doesn't it? Are you having fun yet? 4 years. On December 31st of the first year, you had accumulated net losses of $6,324 and accrued interest of $1,739 for a total of $8,063. Year two, you had additional net losses of $12,378, additional accrued interest of $9,578, leaving you with a debt of $28,280. In year three, you had additional net losses of $11,199, leaving total debt with interest at $53,678. Now it's almost December in year four. Your net losses this year alone, including yesterday's games, yesterday was a bad day for you, are $12,409. Your total liability as of this morning is $83,468. Ralph is stunned. This is not in the ballpark he had imagined. Jesus, is all he can manage to say as the depth of his trouble begins to sink in. The chief nods his head. Ah, yes, the magic of compound interest. Ralph mumbles, that's got to be a bitch of a rate. The chief is annoyed again. 55%. You were fully aware of that when you first opened your account here. So don't give me any of this phony victim shit. For once, Ralph says something honest. I thought I was going to win. His candor is not rewarded. That just proves what I already told you. You, Ralph Collins, are a putz. Ralph the putz is reduced to grasping at straws. I admit, I've been on a losing streak. The last few years have been rough for me. But that just shows that I'm due. My luck is bound to change. The odds are with me now. The laws of chance are in my favor. The chief leans back in his chair. You know that's not true. I do? You know that when you deal with the bookie, you have to factor in the vigorish. When you do that, the odds are never with the better. Yeah, yeah, Ralph says, waving his hand dismissively. I mean, besides that. Oh, well, besides that. The chief leans forward, adjusting his glasses and gazing at the printout. So, here's what the journal for your account is telling us. The cumulative loss of 42,000 and change is a balance of roughly $39,000 in winnings and $81,000 in losses. Those winnings are net of $4,300 in vigorish. So, you're waving away $4,300 as if it were insignificant. Is that how you look at it, petty cash? Ralph backs off. No, 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 I don't mean that. It's just that in the overall scheme of things, the chief fixes his stare. So, you appreciate my point. Ralph is befuddled once again. The chief is becoming exasperated. My point being, your situation is so dire that $4,300 appears insignificant by comparison. Putz? At this point, Ralph wants nothing more than to end the agony and escape from this room. What do you want from me? He pleads. Nothing now. The chief's tone has turned cold, as has his gaze. Ralph says, okay, good, great. His voice sounds relieved. We'll work out a plan to pay you back. This betrays the fact that he hasn't yet internalized the seriousness of his trouble. The chief leans forward. You don't understand. I've lost all confidence that you can pay me back. No, chief, no. Once I start winning again... The chief interrupts. In 42 months, you've been on my books. You've had 6 winning months and 32 losing months. With you, Ralph Collins, losing isn't a random proposition. It's a sure thing. There's a trend here. You don't have to be a PhD in statistics to see it. Okay, says Ralph. I'll start paying off the loan. You can't, says the chief. But I will, says Ralph. The chief raises his voice. Ralph Collins, Sputz, I just told you. He calms down. I just told you how much you owe. Even if you just pay the interest and nothing else, that's $3,655 per month. How you gonna do that, Putz? After the mortgage on your fancy house in your Tony neighborhood and the payments on your prestigious automobile and the minimums on your maxed out credit cards and your dinners out and your trips abroad and your high maintenance wife and your new kid, exactly how much is left to pay me, Putz? Man, I'll do everything I can to put things right. I don't think you get it. What we have here, Ralph Collins, is not random, not the roll of the dice, the luck of the draw. I have already told you, and evidently you were not paying attention. What we have here is a trend, statistical proof, Ralph Collins, that you don't know shit from shinola about betting on sports. I cannot support you anymore. I can't keep throwing good money after bad. I don't think I would ever begin to get my money back from you, which is why, Ralph Collins, I have sold your account to a factor. A factor? A factor. What the hell, Ralphie? Did you flunk out of business school? I majored in communications. Figures. You majored in putts. A factor, putts, buys accounts receivable for cash at a discount and hopes to recover more than he paid. It's a common practice in business. Ralph is getting very tired of this. Are you finished insulting me? I'm finished with you altogether, says the chief. You're Stanley's problem now. Who's Stanley? He's the factor. People call him Cap. It isn't short for captain. It's short for kneecap. He likes to break 'em as a way to focus people's attention. You're talking about a loan shark? The chief is getting tired of Ralph, too. He makes a show of letting his breath out. Yes, Putz. Who did you think was going to be willing to buy your crappy debt? Fucking J.P. Morgan Chase? Ralph is floored by this news. He knew that being called in to see the chief could not be good, but he never expected anything so disastrous. He just stands there, speechless, trying to digest the whole business. He'll be in touch with you, I'm sure, says the chief. The needle on Ralph's tank of self-confidence has come to rest at zero. Chief, how can I possibly pay him? What does a loan shark charge, 100% or so? If I can't pay you 55%, how am I going to pay him 100%? The chief has lost interest. You'll figure something out. Ralph begs. Chief, please, don't do this. I'm one of your best customers. The chief smiles just slightly and snorts. What's funny? Asks Ralph, stupidly. You reminded me of that ancient business joke. We lose money on every item we sell, but we'll make it up in volume. Ralph is back to begging. Chief! The chief is stone cold. Don't humiliate yourself, Ralph Collins. This is already done. Ralph's inner resources are exhausted by now. He feels just as defeated as he in fact is. Giving up, he says, "As long as I'm here, can I at least play some bets on the weekend games?" The chief is flabbergasted. He leans back in his oversized chair and just stares at Ralph for a long time. "You still don't get it, do you?" he says finally. "Your credit is cut off. You can't bet with me unless you bring cash up front." Ralph is stunned. The logic is inescapable. He just hadn't connected the dots before. All at once, his fear is no longer abstract, it's physical. He's feeling queasy, and he can feel the clammy dampness of sweat building under his armpits. What he says next, he says quietly, with utter sincerity and truth. "I can't not bet." "Not my problem," says the chief. "I don't have cash. My credit cards are maxed." "Not my problem." Ralph knows the meeting is over. He gets up from the spindly chair and heads to the door. No goodbyes, no handshake. Leaving the store, he avoids eye contact with Rocco. Dazed, he heads back toward his car. In the mall, there's a restaurant with table service and a bar. He wants to get plastered, but he won't. He has a sales call along with one of his field reps scheduled for 2 o'clock, and now more than ever he needs every sale he can get. Plus, it's one of his core beliefs that, as a manager, it is up to him to lead by example. Plus, he has an ironclad rule that he will never drive his Lexus with more than 2 drinks in his system. So he orders 1 drink, a double, and while he's nursing it, he stews unproductively about his problems. When the food is served, he is startled. He has no recollection of having ordered, much less what he ordered. Oddly, the sight and smell of food makes his stomach feel better, and he realizes he is hungry. The next he's aware, his plate is clean and the check is in front of him. His thoughts are seething and churning all the while, with no productive output. Then it is off to his meeting, where he helps to make the sale. Later on, the sales rep who accompanied Ralph on the call, who had worked for him for nearly 3 years, will not remember Ralph exhibiting any unusual stress that day. When Ralph arrives home that night, Bonnie tells him that there was a message on their home voicemail from somebody named Cap, who left a number for his cell phone. The next morning, Saturday, Ralph makes the call, and they arrange to meet at 5:30 Monday afternoon at the Sheraton in Framingham. Cap has selected this location for its anonymity. It is a large business hotel near a turnpike exit, whose bar should be busy once the meetings taking place in its conference room have finished for the day. Cap's objective is to blend in with the crowd, neither noticed nor remembered. On Monday, Ralph arrives on time. Cap has arrived early in order to make sure nobody who knows him is there, and at 5:30 is watching the door from a stool at the bar. They had described themselves to each other on the phone, so they make contact quickly. Since the room is crowded, they socialize for a while until a table opens up out of the way along the back wall. Once seated, both order beers. It's a compromise. They both relish the calming benefit of hard liquor, but each wants to stay alert and in possession of all his faculties. Ralph doesn't know what to expect, and he knows better than to let too much alcohol dull his concentration. It's Cap's show, and Ralph waits for him to begin. Irrationally, Ralph is comforted by the fact that Cap is smaller than he is and doesn't look especially powerful. Think of, say, Kevin Spacey, the actor. Ralph would be less comfortable were he aware that one of Cap's goons is watching from the bar. Not that the danger is immediate. Cap just wants the goon to know what Ralph looks like for future reference. Cap initiates the conversation before the beers arrive. "This situation," he says, "is like the saying about bankers. It goes, if you owe the bank $5,000 and can't pay, you've got a problem. If you owe the bank $5 million and can't pay, they've got a problem. Well, in this case, I feel like the banker with the problem. The problem, of course, is you. You see what I mean?" Cap pauses and appears to expect a response from Ralph. So Ralph says, "I do. I understand what you're saying. But I'm sure we can work something out." Cap presses, "Do you have a plan?" Ralph, "I've decided to quit gambling."
Cap is dubious. Very admirable. You're a compulsive gambler. What makes you think you can do that?
Ralph is dismayed by this turn in the conversation. He's not stupid, and the idea that he may be compulsive, what some people call addicted, has crossed his mind. But he has long kept the thought buried beneath a mountain of denial. Over the weekend, however, the protective topsoil of rationalization and excuses has been eroding quickly under the monsoon of adverse circumstances that presented themselves in Chelsea. Now his defenses are crumbling further under fresh assault from Cap. The pressure on Ralph's stress circuits is nearing overload, and he really doesn't want to pile on the burden of an acknowledged clinical compulsion. Ralph says, "I can be a pretty determined guy." Cap is unimpressed. He's seen this before, often.
"You still haven't given me an answer."
The beers arrive. Ralph takes a big gulp, then says, "To what?" He's stalling for time, but merely succeeds in irritating Cap.
"Do you have a plan to pay off your debt?" says Cap with an edge.
"I thought we'd work something out right now."
"Okay," Cap says. "Let's start with the fact. Right now, your nut is $3,478 per month. That's pure interest."
Ralph is surprised. "That's less than I owed the chief." Cap lays it out.
"That is because I bought your account from the chief at half of the nominal value. I don't upcharge on the initial amount upstanding. But when you fail to pay the monthly interest in full at 100% annual rate, it will mount up quickly. You can trust me on that."
Ralph chooses his words carefully.
"I don't see how I can come up with $3,500 every month. When I was with the chief, my plan was to win some bets."
Then Ralph has a brainstorm. "Any chance that you can get me set up with someone else so that I can win enough to pay you back?" Cap is bemused.
45 seconds? 50 seconds?
Ralph doesn't get it. He has a puzzled expression. So Cap explains.
50 seconds ago, you declared the end of your gambling. You were determined, you said. It sounded like a commitment. Now you want me to set you up. Some commitment. Your commitment had the half-life of an exotic atomic particle.
Ralph is abashed. "Cap, I don't see what else I can do."
"Sell something or mortgage something."
"I don't have anything. The house is mortgaged to the hilt. I've already drawn down my 401k, what little I had in it. I had some stocks once, but they were dot-coms, and they're all defunct or below water. My cards are maxed. I don't see what else I can do."
Cap knows all this already. He's reviewed Ralph's situation in detail with the chief. In business jargon, Cap has done his due diligence. He is just tightening the screws on Ralph gradually, step by step, to greatest effect.
"Sell the car," he says.
"Sell the car?" Ralph responds in his dumb stalling mode.
Cap shows his impatience.
"The Lexus, putz."
By this, Cap is deliberately telegraphing to Ralph that he is in close communication with the chief and knows everything.
"You sell the Lexus, you lease a Kia, you drive the Impala from your company, she drives the Kia. You'll net more than $20,000 on the deal. You can't keep the money or you'll gamble it all away, so you'll hand it all to me. That will prepay about 6 months' worth of interest. It'll buy you a chunk of time."
"Why wouldn't the $20,000 go to paying down the principal?"
"We can look at it that way. If we do, the interest goes down to about $1,800 a month. But you have to pick up that starting the very next month. Can you handle $1,800 a month any better than you can handle $3,500?
Ralph can't. But now he says what's really on his mind. "There's a big problem with selling the car."
Cap has pretty much guessed what's coming, so he listens intently. Ralph's psychology is key to Cap's plan.
"If I sell the car," Ralph says, "everybody will know my situation."
Gotcha, thinks Cap, jubilant. He is careful not to show it.
What do you mean?
Think about it, Ralph says. Suddenly, for no apparent reason, I sell my beloved Lexus and dump my wife into a friggin' Kia, and the money completely vanishes? How am I supposed to explain all that? What's my wife supposed to think? Her family, my family, the people at work? The questioning would be relentless. If the truth comes out, it will be a total catastrophe. And even if it doesn't, the rumors will be just as bad. I can't face that. I'll be destroyed.
Do you have any choice?
I don't know. I hope so.
What if you told the truth? Is that so terrible? Lance the Boyle, get it over with. It's a big embarrassment, sure, but then it's off your chest. You could get psychological help.
Ralph mulls this over for a while. He knows he shouldn't make any snap decisions. At length he says, "It's possible I could change my mind, but right now I don't see it. Maybe if I went through all that and it really solved the problem once and for all, it might be worth it. I could take my punishment and get over it. The pain would at least have a payback. But selling the car doesn't solve the problem. I'm humiliated and all it gets me is a 6-month respite. Then I'm right back where I started, minus the Lexus."
Exactly, Cap is thinking. Now we're getting somewhere. So he keeps it going.
How about a better job? Can you get a job that pays more?
This hadn't occurred to Ralph. He is taken aback that he hadn't thought of it.
Gee, he says, I don't know. But realistically, I doubt I can make that work. If I have to pay you $42,000 a year, that means I need a salary jump in the range of $70,000 before taxes to cover it. Can I find a job that pays that much more? Seems unlikely.
Good answer, thinks Cap. Cap is methodically leading Ralph through all the alternatives that won't work in order to pave the way for the one that will. He catches the waiter's eye and signals for another round. Turning back to Ralph, he offers another suggestion.
How about a loan from somebody else, a relative, a friend?
Ralph sees this for what it is, a proposal so lame that its sole purpose is to underscore the gravity of his predicament. No way is he about to reveal his problems to either side of his family. He merely moves his head from side to side. The waitress comes with the new beers. Ralph takes his directly from her hand and drains 2/3 of it before setting the glass down on the table. Cap takes a sip from his and decides it is time to let Ralph marinate in his apprehensions for a while. So he leans back and says nothing. Neither does Ralph. Silence. The silence isn't that long, really. 1, 2, 3. Cap is counting the seconds mentally. 6, 7, 8, 9. Precisely 90 seconds. 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. But it is an unnerving experience for Ralph. 22, 23, who doesn't know what to say. 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, and doesn't know what Cap is thinking. 34, 35, 36, and therefore imagines the worst. 39, 40, kneecaps, oh my God! 43, 44, is that what he's going to do to me? 47, 48, now, today? 51, 52, he wants a plan. 55, 56, 57, 58. Oh my God, a kneecap. 61, 62. Bonnie, oh shit, what do I tell Bonnie? 66, 67, 68, 69. Run away, bolt out of here. Escape, hide out. 74, 75. Then what? 77. Yeah, but with my bones intact. 80. 81. Jesus, 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 Jesus. 85. 86. Jesus. 87. 88. 89. 90.
Insurance, Cap says.
Ralph just looks at him, wide-eyed. Cap's eyes bore into Ralph's.
You have to do something.
Ralph spreads his arms, palms up. You tell me.
I'm telling you that the current situation is untenable. I'm telling you that I've invested $40,000 in you, and I will not lose a penny.
Any remnant of composure that entered the room with Ralph flees now.
Cap, I'm trying. I'm thinking like mad. If you break my kneecap and I can't work, that doesn't help the situation.
Cap shakes his head.
Nah, we're a ways yet from the kneecap stage.
If that's supposed to give Ralph some reassurance, it fails. Quite the opposite. Ralph had been hoping that the kneecap thing was an exaggeration, an urban legend with more hype than truth. That hope had just rendezvoused with his composure.
What do you mean by that? He says.
Cap's tone is matter of fact.
I know better than you do, putz, that punishment doesn't help return my investment, at least not directly. That's why I only use it after I've abandoned all hope. At that point, with my investment already down the drain, it yields me a kind of salvage value. That salvage value is what you might call a motivational effect on my other clients.
Motivational, Ralph mutters.
Motivational, Cap repeats. You are motivated, are you not?
Yes, I am motivated, says Ralph.
Good, says Cap. So, think about insurance. Do you have any?
Just regular homeowners.
What else?
Health from the company.
What else? Life?
Yes, that's true on me. It's part of the company benefit package. I forgot about that.
Sometimes, Cap says, people get a big windfall from insurance. You could use a big windfall right about now.
No shit, says Ralph. Then it hits him. Wait a minute, are you talking about burning down the house for the insurance money?
Not exactly.
Good, because that has the same problem as selling the car. How do I explain to Bonnie where all the money went?
Yup, that's a problem.
Not to mention that I could end up in jail. So what are you thinking?
I am thinking more along the lines of life insurance.
You mean my life insurance? Bonnie's the beneficiary. She gets the money.
You could change the beneficiary to me.
Ralph's outrage is for real. Are you crazy? If I'm going to be dead anyway, why would I give you the money or the satisfaction? That's nuts.
Because, putz, we can make your life so miserable you would rather be dead. Dead might be better than crippled, out of work, panhandling on the street, constant pain. Bonnie and the kid moved on. This could be a preferable alternative. A tragic accident over in a fraction of a second. Your reputation preserved. And you don't have to turn all the insurance over to me, just what you owe me. Plus the cost of arranging the accident. And a modest fee for brokering the deal. Depending on your coverage, there could be plenty left for Bonnie.
God damn it to hell. You're talking about my death here as if you were one of my friggin' prospects, discussing the relative merits of alternate copier vendors. Forget it. I'm not ready to die, and I'm not ready to make Bonnie a grieving widow and make our kid fatherless.
At this point, Cap puts his toe into speculative waters. He has no information on the subject, but he has a hunch.
You don't strike me as the kind of person that cares all that much about a kid, especially one you haven't met yet.
Ralph is irate. His tension and fear overwhelm his self-control. He explodes.
You arrogant asshole! What do you know about what I care about, you son of a bitch?
Pay dirt, thinks Cap. Cap, unlike the chief, has no college degree, but like the chief, he's a master at the psychology of everyday human behavior. And one of the patterns he's observed is that when people react badly to criticism, it is invariably because the criticism has hit its mark. People can, and almost always do, shrug off criticism when it's off base. They view the critic as stupid, a statement benign, and dismiss the incident as inconsequential. But criticism which finds its target in truth is threatening, and therefore provokes a defensive reaction. In this regard, Ralph's response is classic. Cap continues to bear down, even as he pretends to back off.
Okay, I didn't mean to offend you. We're just exploring here. I'm still looking for you to come up with a useful suggestion. So far, you're making me do all the work. It's getting me nervous.
I'm trying.
I don't see any heavy lifting. I don't see the effort. I bet you put more effort into selling a copier than you're putting right now into saving your ass.
I'm an expert at selling copiers. At this, Ralph gestures in resignation, I'm out of my league.
That's not good enough, Cap says. You may be out of your league, but you should be motivated. I don't imagine you want to be downgraded to one of my salvage value projects, right?
No.
It hurts like hell, Ralph. It never stops hurting. It only stops when you die, and you would want to die sooner rather than later. But you can't if what you just told me is true.
Once again, Ralph is confused. Huh? Cap, condescendingly, with exaggerated patience,
you just told me not 2 minutes ago that you don't want to leave Bonnie a widow and your kid fatherless. But if you are in such pain that you decide to end it all, that would be the outcome, widow and orphan. In addition, your life insurance will pay nothing on a suicide. You know that, don't you?
Ralph stares morosely at his empty beer glass.
What about Bonnie? Cap says.
Ralph looks up.
Is Bonnie insured? Cap asks.
The word alarmed hardly begins to convey the sensation Ralph is experiencing just now. He continues to look up.
Cap repeats. Is Bonnie insured? Yes or no?
No.
Okay. It's natural to take out insurance on the wife when she is pregnant. If a wife dies and the husband has to raise a kid alone, the additional expenses are devastating. Child care, housekeeping, food, doctors, clothing, it's major. The economic value of a wife and mother in a household is underappreciated, but real. So mothers are insured all the time. But, hypothetically speaking, naturally, if Bonnie were insured and something were to happen to her before the baby is born, then all of your problems would disappear, hypothetically speaking.
Ralph's reaction is immediate. You are certifiably deranged. Cap is calm.
It's the only rational solution, Ralph, and don't forget, if you insure her for enough, there'll be plenty left over for you to have a very nice stake to start placing bets again with cash. Another problem solved. It's a twofer, Ralph. And, Ralph, you don't have to get your hands dirty. We take care of everything for a fee, of course. All you have to do is arrange an alibi. Out of town at a business meeting is good.
At first, Ralph can hardly believe what he is hearing. But Cap is looking him straight in the eyes, and Ralph knows he has not misunderstood. This is Unreal, he is thinking. This is the Twilight Zone. He's a putz, maybe, possibly. All right, if you say so. But a criminal? A murderer? His own family? All he can think to do is get up and storm out of the room. So he does that. The goon shoots Cap a glance from his stool at the bar, wondering whether he should prevent Ralph from leaving. Cap raises his palm upright and shakes his head no. Cap is more than satisfied. The seed has been planted.